interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. Their goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative high-tech productions for exports.
Research steered by scientific investigation plays a huge role in product development. At its core, advanced technology is created by adding valuable features to items that have specialized uses. And academic and research institutions are the bridge between ideas and the commercialization of products. Several universities across Iran are providing services to help support knowledge-based startups.
High technology is a product of advancements in national academic and scientific research. Iran possesses a lot of intellectual prowess as a whole. Evidence of this can be seen by the high number of academic publications both nationally and internationally. Nearly 70,000 academic articles were published in 2020 alone to show for it. Figures from the International Web of Science show Iran was globally ranked 16th in 2019 for its citation work. Numerous knowledge-based companies that provide valuable research and products are born out of university, tech park, and trade zone incubators. These establishments provide platforms that support the creation of new businesses in various fields of advanced tech development as they start up. Incubators offer services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully execute their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. Moreover, incubators are an access channel for services such as workspaces and facilities, technical and legal consultations. These are important for the sustainability of both existing firms as well as innovative startup businesses. The goal is to increase regional economic growth and diversify the national economy. Such development support also strengthens the tech ecosystem and improves investment opportunities. Fire clay is basically mud, but a lighter, stickier type of mud with high alumina content. It's actually everywhere around us, but cannot be seen until it is uncovered from the earth. In its raw form, fire clay is found near or between layers of coal in coal mines. People have been extracting it from the ground for millennia to make bricks, ceramicware, tools homes, and a whole bunch of other things. Its qualities get even better when it's baked and stiffened. This clay has a great number of industrial uses and lasts nearly forever. Our quest for answers led us to a company that owns and manages at least 5 mines in Fars province. Esterlal Abadi Company specializes in the extraction of fire clay and the production of clay products. Fire clay is a refractory material that can withstand extremely high temperatures without losing its original properties. There are other types of refractories that this company also produces in small amounts, such as high alumina and melite ceramics. But its main claim to fame is the production of highly useful fire clay. It might be interesting to know that this company is not just a mine owner. It also has 3 factories. These factories make products like fire brick, washroom items such as sinks, and industrial ceramics. Its production facilities can make large amounts of ceramic parts that are used in various fields such as blast furnaces for coke, iron, and steel productions.
Because fire clay is heat-resistant, this material presents excellent qualities for outdoor flooring purposes. One of the benefits is it doesn't crack or expand when exposed to hot climates. That is why it is widely used across the country, particularly in central and southern regions where temperatures can often exceed 45 degrees Celsius.
The quality of fire clay is assessed by its levels of impurities. This company can produce some of the highest-grade fire clays in the West Asian region with around 75% purity. In general, when the material is extracted, it is then transferred to the research and development department where it is tested for quality. One of the competitive advantages of this company over similar firms in this field is the quality of its products that match international standards. This holding company has created dozens of direct job opportunities over the years, and hundreds more people are indirectly hired as well. Out of some 50 fire clay mines nationwide, this mine has been the only producer that extracts its products along the lines of exports. This company has faced many challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Some are related to the fluctuation of domestic raw material prices. As part of its future vision, it has also overhauled production processes to optimize outputs. Besides the mine we just talked about, there is one other major fire clay deposit which is located in Charmahal-e Bakhtiari province. This mine offers 12 million tons of proven reserves, and it is set to produce some of the best quality refractories in the region. Each year, a combined average of 300,000 tons of fire clay are exported. Iran's tile and ceramic market have become very attractive with rapid socioeconomic development in the West Asian region. Also, there is an increasing need for new housing units in neighboring countries. There are some of the things that are driving Iran's export market in this field. So the country has stepped up its production to gain a larger share of the market. We looked at the latest figures from the Ministry of Industry to gain more insight into the productions in this field. Data showed that in the year 2020, roughly 400 million square meters of tile were produced in Iran. Such productions were estimated to be worth nearly $450 million. These productions were more than local needs, so nearly 160 million square meters of tiles were exported. Industry participants say that this sector is presently operating at only half of its total production capacity, adding that it has high export potential. With this in mind, the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade is working with the government to find ways to expand its markets through production. The goal is to increase production levels by 300 million square meters over the next 4 years. Analysts estimate that this will generate an additional $2 billion in foreign revenues if the strategic sector taps into the full capabilities. Fire clay does not only feed the tile productions. It also supplies raw material to manufacturers of sanitary ceramic ware, such as sinks. Iran currently makes copious amounts of these items. In fact, in the first half of last year alone, over 70,000 tons of sanitary ware were released into the market. Going off on information from the National Customs Administration, these items were mainly exported to neighboring countries. The country's light and heavy construction sector is booming with construction materials in high demands. It is worth noting that domestic raw materials such as fire clay meet 100% of Iran's construction needs. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here are some statistics on the construction materials market. Iran's steel, cement, tile, and ceramic industries produced more than twice the country's internal needs. Last year, exports of these items raked in some $10 billion in foreign revenues. Tile, glass, and ceramic exports composed some $3 billion of total exports. Steel exports accounted for the rest. That's all based on statistics from the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. On another note, the country's mega mining and metal sector, which also supplies the construction sector, has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. Industry participants say this was mainly due to the U.S. sanctions on the oil industry, which led to more focus on other sectors. Much of this expansion is in large part made possible by linking research institutions with manufacturers. This step was critical for sharing knowledge in collaborative product development. Catalysts are the unsung heroes of the chemical reactions that make human society tick by. They help speed up chemical processes between molecules that might have been taking years to interact. Factories rely on catalysts to make everything from plastic to drugs. Catalysts also help process petroleum and coal into liquid fuels and are key players in clean energy technologies as well. However, their biggest use happens in the oil and gas industries.
All right, everyone. Now I will pass it over to my colleague who has prepared an interesting feature program for you all. Let's take a look.
You definitely have a clear image of a concrete or a steel structure, but when it comes to tensile structures, you most likely cannot picture anything. They're self-standing structures carrying only tension and no compression. Mostly made of membrane or industrial fabrics, they're most often used for roofs and canopies, creating unique private and public spaces. Mahout is the name of an Iranian company that makes all kinds of tensile structures. Tensile structures can cover vast areas. While they're lightweight compared to other types of construction, they're extremely strong. Tensile fabric structures are designed and engineered to withstand even the most severe weather conditions, providing protection from both rain and sun. Mahout says its products are made using the latest technology and high-quality materials, on par with their international peers. Mahout has under its belt a dedicated team of experts who are constantly exploring new trends and efficient designs for eye-catching yet resilient tensile structures. While the Iranian brand has a strong foothold in Iran's market and is eyeing higher horizons, Mahout says it's working to undertake international projects. Offering a unique landscape for outdoor eateries, restaurants, and coffee shops, tensile structures are beginning to attract more attention in the architecture industry. This means the future market will be lucrative for the actors in this field. And Mahout says it will stand out, as it believes quality is in the details.
There is so much more that can be said about knowledge-based products, so let's take a look at some news and trends in this field. You have probably heard the phrase NFT, or non-fungible tokens, being thrown around recently. The very first Iranian NFT issuance platform was established and launched in the country.
The platform is called Bita. It was created by a company in the field of developing digital technologies in the information communication technology sector. Bita digitally certifies artistic and non-artistic works in the form of non-fungible tokens. The developer says it plans to increase international access and grow the platform's ecosystem to determine accurate asset values. People can purchase NFT that are backed by authentic art approved by the system and sold at auction.
Most people don't think twice about fungi, but what if it could be used to help treat diseases? Well, an Iranian knowledge-based company has managed to come up with the technology to produce rare medicinal fungi.
This company focused on producing four species of medicinal fungi. Once cultivation conditions have been established, these plants can be mass-produced. Its medicinal properties will be used in the form of tablets and capsules. These fungi have the potential to treat liver disease, immune deficiencies, diabetes, and some skin diseases. Plus, the four species can now be cultivated in 3 months.
The number of cars and pollution increases as cities grow, and one way to manage this issue is to create specialized technology. Domestic knowledge-based companies and startups have developed 17 innovative products to improve road traffic and reduce air pollution.
The products were developed to address the rising number of vehicles and inner-city trips in cities nationwide. Some of these smart products are used to record traffic violations, collect traffic information, and license systems for restricted traffic zones, among many others. Smart traffic monitoring systems have also been developed by these companies.
We are fresh out of time for our program for today. Thank you for tuning in, and I will see you right here next time for another edition of Bazaar.
option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The U.S. state of Oregon, which is Democrat-controlled, could pass a new bill that could criminalize environmental protest as terrorism. This state could become the 20th in the U.S. to enact a so-called critical infrastructure law. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truthout, a bill that could stifle environmental protest has emerged in an unlikely place, the Democrat-controlled Oregon State Legislature. Lawmakers in the Beaver State are considering a bill that could make disruption of services provided by so-called critical infrastructure, which includes roads, pipelines, electrical substations, and some oil and gas infrastructure, a felony punishable by up to 10 years in prison and $250,000 in fines. The bill labels such activity domestic terrorism. The bill's sponsor, Democratic State Representative Paul Evans, and other proponents argue that the legislation is necessary to adequately punish extremists who may seek to damage facilities that provide essential public services. The bill appears to be a direct response to the 2022 racial justice protests that turned violent in Portland and the breach of the state capitol in Salem by far-right protesters the same year. A recent report by the Oregon Secretary of State claims that the state has experienced one of the highest rates of domestic violent extremism in the country, and that critical infrastructure continues to be a high-risk target. What happens when someone decides that for a fun evening they're going to go out and destroy an electrical substation that cripples the community for a day, a week? Evans said during a committee hearing, adding, "The fact is, we have some gaps in the way in which we approach those sorts of crimes." But existing state laws already make trespassing and property damage criminal offenses, and environmental and civil liberties advocates are concerned that decreasing disruption of services to be domestic terrorism could result in charges for nonviolent protesters who may block a road, bridge, or oil and gas site during a protest. He said, "That's the stuff that could happen at ordinary protest." Nick Caleb, an attorney with the environmental nonprofit Bridge Collective, said, adding that this bill may not have received much traction prior to 2020, but that the violent events of that year changed the calculus for many lawmakers, adding, "Suddenly there is enough Democrats that also think labeling things as terrorism will have an effect on stopping that type of disruptive activity." The bill is still in the early stages of consideration.
It successfully passed out of the State House Committee and has received a hearing, but it has several more hurdles to clear in both chambers before it can become law. As the state legislatures kick into high gear this year, many other states are proposing and passing similar legislation. In the last few months, state legislatures in Georgia, Tennessee, and Utah have all passed bills that increase penalties for interfering with or damaging critical infrastructure. A number of other states, including Minnesota, Illinois, North Carolina, and Oklahoma, have similar legislation pending. Over the last 6 years, at least 19 states have passed this kind of critical infrastructure law. The bills were first proposed after the 2017 Standing Rock protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline received national attention. In response, primarily Republican lawmakers explicitly cited the Standing Rock protest as the impetus for the legislation. But this year, lawmakers have mostly pointed to a more recent spate of attacks on electrical substations in North Carolina, Washington, and Oregon as the reason such critical infrastructure bills are needed. Advocates in Oregon have pointed to other events in Georgia as an example of the ways in which a domestic terrorism bill could be used to target protesters. Georgia lawmakers first expanded the state's definition of domestic terrorism in 2017 to include crimes committed with the intent to alter, change, or coerce the policy of the government. Since then, the law has been used to target environmental activists protesting the construction of a police training center, colloquially referred to as Cop City. Of the roughly 2 dozen protesters arrested under the law, arrest warrants showed that several were being charged with domestic terrorism, even though they weren't alleged to have engaged in any specific illegal activity other than trespassing. Sarah Alvarez, staff attorney with the Civil Liberties Defense Center, said there was a stated reason for why the Georgia law was passed to target mass shootings, adding, "Now it's being twisted to apply to environmental protesters who haven't harmed anyone. That is the concern that I have when I look at the Oregon bill."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Gaza Strip, and yet again, another Israeli deadly aggression on the blockaded territory that finally ended following an Egypt-brokered truce on Saturday. The 5-day onslaught claimed the lives of over 30 people, including women and children. The Palestinian fatalities included several Islamic Jihad commanders. Khalil al-Bahtini, the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the northern Gaza Strip, Tariq Azzedine, a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, who also managed retaliatory operations in the West Bank and Gaza, and Jihad al-Ghannam, secretary of the movement's military council, were all among those assassinated along with their families. A total of 51 Palestinian houses were completely destroyed, while about 1,000 others were damaged, prompting many people across Gaza to become homeless.
Now we are homeless, so we have no choice but to sleep on the street. Everything of us is ruined. I am worried about my children and other family members.
I demand compensation following this ceasefire because we are living on the streets now, no house or anything. My children and their children have no home. We are all left with nothing.
The conflict marked the worst episode of fighting between Gaza's resistance factions and the Israeli regime since the 10-day war in 2021. The carnage was to the extent which drew reaction from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza as unacceptable. The UN chief also called on the Israeli regime to immediately stop the bloodshed. Guterres said Israel must abide by its obligations under international humanitarian law, including proportionate use of force and taking all feasible precautions to spare civilians and civilian objects in the conduct of military operations. The UN chief also censured the Israeli closure of Gaza border crossings, which prevented the entry of foodstuff, medical supplies, and fuel into the besieged coastal territory. The latest Israeli aggression on Gaza brings to the spotlight the power and strength the Palestinian resistance groups have attained during the past several years. A joint statement by resistance factions in Gaza is a testimony to that. The statement said the retaliatory rocket attacks and the steadfastness of resistance fighters messed up the regime's calculations during the recent onslaught on Gaza. It added the new round of fighting with the occupying Israeli regime further strengthened the resistance front. The Zionist enemy mistakenly believed that the time was ripe for assassination of Palestinian resistance leaders, but it was a grave miscalculation. The umbrella group said that Israeli military officials had planned to wrap up the latest onslaught on the Gaza Strip in a very short span of time, but were stunned by the scope of resistance fighters' preparedness and rapid response to air raids. The groups warned Israel against the implementation of the policy of targeted killings, adding that resistance fighters have their fingers on the trigger and will not hesitate to respond in case the regime in Tel Aviv resorts to assassinations. But with Israeli officials admitting that the Islamic Jihad fired 6,000 rockets toward the occupied territories, it seems that the power of Palestinian resistance has already done the job, creating fear and threat among Israeli authorities. With all the fuss about the Israeli Iron Dome, numerous Palestinian rockets managed to intrude into the airspace of the occupied territories and inflict their stated losses. The death of an Israeli settler as a result of those rocket fires during the recent conflict was an indication of that. What seems to be of very high significance is that assassinating Palestinian commanders will not bring security to the Israeli regime and instead will enhance the extent of resistance on the part of Palestinian factions and increase their resolve in the face of the Israeli atrocities. That not only will cost Israel a heavy price in case of any gross miscalculations, as resistance leaders have put it, but will undoubtedly challenge the existence of an occupying regime. The United States and yet another example of racial discrimination. A video circulating on social media has showed a former U.S. Marine killing a mentally ill African-American homeless man by putting him in a chokehold on the New York City subway. The video shows a former Marine, identified as Daniel Penny, grabbing 30-year-old Jordan Neely around the neck while pinning him to the ground on a train in Manhattan. The medical examiner said Neely died from a compression of the neck. The incident happened on May the 1st. Witnesses say the African-American man was loudly complaining about being hungry and saying he was ready to die. They say the victim showed no behavior that was threatening to the subway passengers. Penny, 24, restrained him until the homeless man appeared to stop moving. Neely was taken to a hospital, where he was later declared dead. Penny's lawyers say their client could not have known that his forceful actions, which were meant to subdue the mentally ill man, would lead to the victim's death. Penny, who had been questioned and released by police in New York on the day of the incident, later surrendered to police and was arraigned in Manhattan Criminal Court after prosecutors lodged criminal charges against him. Two other unidentified people who were also seen restraining Neely in the footage have yet to be charged. Neely's death sparked angry protests.
Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan!
A system that has been meant to destroy us. A system that didn't want to see Jordan Neely alive.
Right.
Let me be very clear. It failed no one. It did exactly what it was designed to do.
The demonstrators called Neely's death an act of lynching, likening it to the murder of George Floyd by white officers in 2020. The killing of the African-American man also drew reactions from some U.S. officials. New York City Mayor Eric Adams called the incident a tragedy that never should have happened. He pledged to do more to help people experiencing mental health crisis. The latest incident of racial discrimination in the U.S. comes as brutality against black people is happening at record numbers. Just to make that evident, 21 African Americans were killed by U.S. law enforcement officers only in January 2023. That already makes the year one of the deadliest ever so far for the African American community in the U.S. That includes the tragic death of Keena Darnell Anderson, who was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident. Those are only a few recent incidents of brutality of racial discrimination against blacks. The United States has a long history of such bias against people of color. One major example was a brutal killing of a 46-year-old black man named George Floyd, who died after a white police officer pressed on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest in May 2020 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The death of the handcuffed black man triggered months of widespread protests, not only in cities across the U.S., but also other parts of the world. Those incidents come as African Americans and other ethnic minorities are often subject to harsh discrimination and racial profiling by white supremacists in the United States. One reason could be that U.S. politicians not only have failed to bring an end to racial profiling against the people of color, but at times have fanned the flames of hatred against them. That could clearly be seen when former U.S. President Donald Trump was in office. The former president numerously emboldened white supremacists with his racist remarks during his tenure. U.S. President Joe Biden, who took the helm in 2021, claimed to be a critic of racial injustice, but he also failed to eradicate racial discrimination in the country. With many arguing that America was built on slavery, it is not erroneous to claim that racial profiling against African Americans and other people of color is deeply rooted in American culture. Maybe that's why it is too early to think that putting an end to prejudice and racism in the U.S. does not seem to be happening anytime soon.
Shock and desperation. Children traumatized. Mothers losing their children. Israel claims it is not targeting civilians, but the injured and the dead tell another story. Like dead Palestinian girl carried by her father. With over 100 wounded, how many times will Israel kill civilians like women and children? It claim it is targeting resistance fighters and leaders. When is it enough?
Are you ready to say enough is enough? As the highest authority responsible for the maintenance of international peace and security?
As of Saturday, May 13, Israel has so far assassinated 6 Islamic Jihad leaders, and it has stated it is after more blood. The killing machine has no mercy. One bombing operation involved 40 aircrafts and drones, courtesy of the United States. The incessant sound of drones creates a constant state of terror, panic, and anxiety among the 2 million people living in the Gaza Strip. Al-Mizan, a human rights group based in Gaza, notes that between the years 2000 and 2023, at least 2,148 Palestinians, including 378 children and 86 women, were killed by Israeli drones. Nearly 350 were killed inside their homes, including more than 100 children, underscoring the reality that there is no safe place in Gaza. And these are conservative figures. Resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have not stood idle. Palestinian factions like the Islamic Jihad said they are united in their joint response. Resistance factions have been relentless in their rocket attacks. Many have reached as far as Tel Aviv, or close to it, like the town, which claimed the life of one Israeli, injuring five others. Israel getting a taste of its own medicine. As a matter of fact, the resistance group's firepower has overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome system. In one tally, more than 500 rockets were fired at Israel. Of these, 368 rockets made it over the border, and 154 were intercepted by the so-called Iron Dome missile defense system. Simple math shows that this dome had a 30% success rate. And Israel better be careful. Reports indicate it has so far only hit Islamic Jihad targets. Israel knows that Palestinian resistance groups are believed to be capable of firing thousands of rockets, which could quickly exhaust Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system. On top of that, Israel is unable to sustain prolonged disruption to its civilian economy amid widespread fear and panic among its population. Israel is now at its weakest. Regionally, it is isolated more than ever. Iran and Saudi Arabia's reconciliation have solidified the axis of resistance, especially after Saudi Arabia hosted Hamas recently and is warming up to Hezbollah. And from within, Israel is unraveling due to the revolt by Israelis against the judicial reforms. Protests now in its fourth month. There's growing consensus that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu launched the assault on Gaza to appease his fractious, extreme coalition, particularly Itamar Ben-Gvir, in order to distract from the protests. Yet Netanyahu may be risking it all when the Tel Aviv skyline is filled with too many rockets that would rain down and eliminate its presence on Palestinian land. The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Congress to raise the $31.4 trillion debt limit and avert an unprecedented default, saying that a failure to do so would have dire consequences. Yellen's comments come after she warned of an economic catastrophe if the U.S. fails to raise its debt ceiling in the coming weeks. She has also previously warned that the U.S. could fail to meet its debt obligations sooner than expected, and it may run out of measures as early as June 1. Yellen issued the latest in a series of increasingly stark warnings in remarks prepared for a press conference meeting in Japan with her counterparts from the group of seven G7 rich nations, as well as India, Indonesia, and Brazil. Yellen's comments came as a political stalemate over raising the debt limit was forcing the Treasury Department dangerously close to worst-case scenario, which is a potential U.S. debt default.
The notion of defaulting on our debt is something that would so badly undermine the U.S. and global economy that I think it should be regarded by everyone as unthinkable.
In order to avoid a default on the nation's debt, Congress must vote to either raise or suspend the debt limit before the Treasury runs out of emergency funding. But with only days left this month, time is running out to reach a deal. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. The last time this happened, the U.S. saw its credit rating downgraded and interest rates on its existing debt go up. Even if the nation avoids tumbling over the fiscal cliff, the U.S. economy could suffer.
They're doing the best, to the best of my knowledge, what no other political party has done in the nation's history. They're literally, not figuratively, holding the economy hostage by threatening to default on our nation's debt that we've already incurred.
The debt ceiling is the maximum amount the U.S. government is legally authorized to borrow to meet its obligations. Many investors are bracing for the economic fallout of the deadline for the U.S. to raise the debt ceiling or default on its obligations. The U.S. government has run a deficit averaging nearly $1 trillion every year since the year 2001, meaning that it spends that much more money than it receives in taxes and other revenues.
Congress has told Treasury, you should pay our bills, you should pay our debt. But at the same time, it's told it, you can't borrow anymore to pay those bills and debt. And at the same time, Congress has authorized all of the spending that's being done. So the spending's going out the door. The bills are showing up at Treasury, and Treasury isn't getting enough revenue from taxpayers to pay the bills. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing over what Treasury should do.
Even short of a default, hitting the debt ceiling would stop the government's ability to finance its operations, including providing for the national defense or funding entitlements such as Medicare or Social Security. The default could cause the loss of 3 million jobs, add $130,000 to the cost of an average 30-year mortgage, and raise interest rates enough to increase the national debt by $850 billion. Meanwhile, the recent turmoil in the banking industry have concerned investors. In early May, officials closed San Francisco-based First Republic Bank, making it the third U.S. bank to collapse in the past 2 months. Most of First Republic's assets are being acquired by J.P. Morgan, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, whose clients were mostly from the tech industry, collapsed in March under similar circumstances. But they are not alone. The U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that 722 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Those losses have occurred because banks bought lots of treasuries and bonds when interest rates were near zero. Now, as the Federal Reserve raises rates to combat inflation, the value of these bonds has declined.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
Despite the White House's rhetoric about supporting global democracy, the U.S. regime sold weapons in 2022 to 57% of the world's authoritarian regimes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Intercept reported, since President Joe Biden came to office in 2021, he has described a battle between democracies and autocracies in which the U.S. and other democracies strive to create a peaceful world. The reality, however, is that the Biden administration has helped increase the military power of a large number of authoritarian countries. According to an Intercept review of recently released government data, the U.S. regime sold weapons to at least 57% of the world's autocratic countries in 2022. Since the end of the Cold War, the United States has been the world's biggest weapons dealer, accounting for about 40% of all arms exports in a given year. In general, these exports are funded through grants or sales. There are two pathways for the latter category: foreign military sales and direct commercial sales. The U.S. regime acts as an intermediary for FMS acquisitions. It buys the material from a company first and then delivers the goods to the foreign recipient. DCS acquisitions are more straightforward. They are the result of an agreement between a U.S. company and a foreign government. Both categories of sales require the government's approval. Country-level data for last year's DCS authorizations was released in late April through the U.S. State Department's Directorate of Defense Trade Controls. FMS figures for fiscal year 2022 were released earlier this year through the Pentagon's Defense Security Cooperation Agency. According to their data, a total of 142 countries and territories bought weapons from the U.S. in 2022 for a total of $85 billion in bilateral sales. How many of those countries were democracies and how many were autocracies? That question can be answered by comparing the new U.S. arms sales data to political regime data from the Varieties of Democracy project at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, which uses a classification system that's called Regimes of the World. The system classifies regimes into four categories: closed autocracy, electoral autocracy, electoral democracy, and liberal democracy. For a country to be classified as a democracy, it must have multi-party elections and political freedoms that make those elections meaningful. According to this methodology, the dividing line between democracies and autocracies is whether a country's leaders are accountable to their citizens through free and fair elections. Of the 84 countries codified as autocracies under the regimes of the world system in 2022, the United States sold weapons to at least 48 or 57% of them. The "at least" qualifier is necessary because several factors frustrate the accurate tracking of U.S. weapon sales. The U.S. State Department's report of commercial arms sales during the fiscal year makes the prodigious use of various in its recipients category. As a result, the specific recipient for nearly $11 billion in weapon sales are not disclosed. The regimes of the world system is just one of the several indices that measure democracy worldwide, but running the same analysis with other popular indices produces similar results. For example, Freedom Home listed 195 countries, and for each one labeled whether it qualified as an electoral democracy in its annual Freedom in the World report. Of the 85 countries, Freedom House did not designate as an electoral democracy. The United States sold weapons to 49 or 58% of them in fiscal year 2022. These findings contradict Biden's preferred framing of international politics as fundamentally a struggle in which the world's democracies, led by the U.S., are on the side of peace and security, as he called it in last year's State of the Union address. Opposing the United States and its democratic allies are the autocracies that collude to undermine the international system, Biden has claimed. In a speech in Warsaw last year, he said the battle between democracy and autocracy is one between liberty and repression, and between a rules-based international order and one governed by brute force. The White House's 2022 National Security Strategy adds, "The most pressing strategic challenge facing our vision is from powers that layer authoritarian governance with a revisionist foreign policy." Despite that rhetoric, a review of the new data suggests instead a business-as-usual approach to weapon sales. Former President Donald Trump based his arms sales policy primarily on economic considerations, corporate interests above all else. In Biden's first full fiscal year as president, weapon sales from the United States to other countries reached $206 billion, according to the State Department's annual tally, which uses an opaque but seemingly broader accounting of yearly FMS and DCS figures. Biden's first year total surpasses the Trump-era high of $192 billion. The multi-billion dollar effort to train and equip Ukraine doesn't fully explain the dramatic rise in total arms sales last year, let alone to autocracies. Rather, the new figures reveal the continuity between Republican and Democratic administrations in the United States. While Biden signaled early on that his arms sales policy would be based primarily on strategic and human rights considerations, not just economic interests, he broke from that policy not too long after entering office by approving weapon sales to authoritarian regimes.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023. In my opinion, it was good to see you mentioning the names of the late Shahid Mutahhari, Shahid Beheshti, and the late Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, and others like them. Their books are good. The experiences that our youths have had are also good. Now, let's say, for example, that a young Basiji near Tehran, such as Shahid Mustafa Sadrzadeh, is active and making an effort. A couple of books have been written about him that I have read. In these books, you see how much he strove to work hard and move forward. We should see these things and move forward. This was the first point that I wanted to make. I would like to say a few things about university students. I must talk about this quickly so that we can cover everything. The first point is this. You need to know that this is my definite opinion. The student activities, like the students themselves, are an opportunity for the country. Some people might feel threatened by some of the student activities or any kind of activity. Of course, healthy activities. I will talk about some of the problems with these soon. They are mistaken. Student activities are an opportunity for the country. The demands of students are an opportunity. A student's language is an opportunity.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The sense of responsibility that students feel with regard to the events taking place in their country is an opportunity. The fact that you put in effort to come here with exuberance and excitement, and you cite such and such problems, this is an opportunity for the country. This is something valuable for the nation. The enthusiasm that the student community and young students have for solving problems is an opportunity. The sensational presence of students in various events, whether in natural events or in political events such as the Quds Day March, the walk of the 22nd of Bahman and the like, are all important opportunities. The opinions expressed regarding political matters, economic issues and some decisions, these are opportunities. These opinions are opportunities. I'm not saying they are correct. Pay attention to this. Some of them may be correct, others may not be. But the act of expressing your opinion and thinking about a problem, this is an opportunity for the country. Of course, it is possible for there to be damages associated with it. Student activities should not suffer from deviations. Be careful.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip marked the 75th anniversary of the Nakba Day, also known as the Day of Catastrophe, in front of the United Nations office. Nakba Day marks the displacement of Palestinians upon the establishment of the Israeli regime in 1948, when Zionists drove out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the historic land of Palestine. According to UN figures, there are currently around 5 million registered Palestinian refugees. Around 1.3 million refugees live in the Gaza Strip and reside in 8 refugee camps under miserable living conditions. The Palestinian Legislative Council in Gaza also held a special session commemorating 75 years of Nakba and called on the international community to stop turning a blind eye to the plight of Palestinians.
Palestinians expressing their disappointment of the UN representing the international community who had created the Zionist entity in 1948, and until now, after 75 years, they are failing to respond to the Palestinians ambitions and dreams of an independent, sovereign state.
Palestinian refugees, their children and their grandchildren hold sacred the right to return to the land of their ancestors. 75 years on, Palestinian refugees say they have not lost hope of taking back what is rightfully theirs.
In this 75th anniversary of Nakba, we said our right.